This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Amat Fuad Ramat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts, the better to understand how society works. Each week, we will discuss a concept or a classic text that we hope will shed light on the world around you. This week, we have a rather large word we're going to deal with. It's heteroglossia, and that concept was developed by the Russian theorist Mikhail Bakhtin, a literary scholar. And to help us think through this issue is Nezia Azmi. She's been on the show before. She is a cultural worker whose current engagement is with Rhythm and Bronze, a contemporary gamelan Malaysian troupe. She's trained in Southeast Asian studies at the University of Hawaii. Welcome back, Nezia.
Hi.
So, how do we begin?
So, I came across the concept when I was in graduate school. I was focusing primarily on the performing arts traditions of Southeast Asia. And when I was researching about shadow puppet theater, I came across this concept. Heteroglossia was used by a couple of scholars to explain the nuances in Thai shadow theater. So then I looked more into it, and I felt that, you know, this was actually a possible unifying concept for most shadow puppet theater traditions throughout the archipelago. So that's why I thought it was interesting to bring it into your audience, because it's a new way for us to look at what we have here. We might not have had a long tradition of the written word. We're more of a kind of oral tradition sort of, you know, society. So this is one way to look at it and see it more interestingly.
But what about the origins of the concept? It obviously, did it begin in Southeast Asia? Was it there? Was it in the works coming out of Southeast Asia that this idea was conceptualized around that notion of heteroglossia?
The coining of it was, of course, done in a totally different context, in a totally different part of the world. So Bakhtin was looking at Western literature. Primarily, he was looking at the works of, you know, people like Dickens, Charles Dickens, that is, Dostoevsky, and, you know, people like that. But what was also interesting to me was just how uncanny the similarities are. And so this goes to show, I guess, you know, kind of the patriotic side of me is just because shadow puppets is, you know, some guy playing with dolls doesn't mean it's not actually deep. In fact, it's very deep. And this is the part that most, you know, the layperson in Malaysia wouldn't really know about shadow puppet theater.
But it's deep, but also by implication universal, because it has expressions that somehow resonates with something that Bakhtin wrote in a different context.
Right, exactly.
I mean, I'm very interested in the idea that literary scholars actually do theory, because you often think of literary scholars as being involved in appreciation of, you know, of literary works. They read stories and say, well, you know, great characterization,
right,
and the plot was very strong,
right,
or they look at structure and such and such. What is it that Bakhtin was looking at when he developed this theory?
Sure. So, he's, I guess, a 19th century, beginning of 19th century into the 20th century kind of guy. So during his time, I think in a way he was perplexed by the dearth of theorizing on the novel, because during that time, the novel was so new. You know, people were used to reading things like, you know, Homer's Odyssey or the Iliad, you know, the epic poetry. So when the novel came in, the novel had a lot of, I think, political power. So the author doesn't necessarily have to subscribe to any kind of hagiographic writing. You know, so he or she can have multiple voices, for example, in writing a particular scene. Satire is probably the most common occurrence of this. So he was theorizing on that. It's not that people didn't know about satire before Bakhtin, you know, started theorizing, but that he put it into the academic sphere as a way to elevate the novel as a genre. He basically identified the novel as a way for us to understand human society, and what he was, I think, gunning for is that it's much more powerful than any other literary genres of our time.
Short footnote, hagiography is a story about a saint, isn't it? So to kind of like hero worship.
So you're always writing good things about it.
Like
our hikayats and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's written for a particular audience to praise a particular person or royalty. So it rarely criticizes.
Okay. So where's that overlap between the kind of theory that Bakhtin produced and the performance of the shadow puppets themselves?
Sure. So when I started reading up on, you know, heteroglossia and all the other kind of Bakhtin buzzwords that you know, or sub-concepts that came along with it, such as polyphony, chronotope, the carnivalesque, the grotesque, I couldn't stop seeing the dalang. The dalang is the shadow puppet master, and in a way the dalang is like the novel's author, and the dalang does all the voices of all the different characters. Now this essay is titled Discourse in the Novel, but it's part of a collection of essays, and the entire collection is called the Dialogic or the Dialogic Imagination. So in a way it's the first time. In a way, when Bakhtin is talking about written, you know, literature, and in a way, the dalang personifies heteroglossia. I'm not sure if, you know, literary scholars of today who focus on Western literary theorists would agree with this, but, you know, this is why academic is exciting. You can kind of make these connections on your own.
But at this point, do you want to define heteroglossia?
Yeah. So hetero is many, mm-hmm. right? And glossia is voice, utterances, speeches. I'll go first with what Bakhtin was looking at, and mm-hmm. then maybe I'll give a brief example of it in the Shadow Puppet Theatre. So Dickens might be describing a scene in one of his novels where he's talking about a government official, and I'll just read a quick I'll add intonation in it to indicate where the kind of satiric heteroglossic part is. The conference was held at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, when all the region of Harley Street, Cavendish Square was resonant of carriage wheels and double knocks. It had reached this point when Mr. Myrtle came home from his daily occupation of causing the British name to be more and more respected in all parts of the civilized globe, capable of appreciation of worldwide commercial enterprise and gigantic combinations of skill and capital. So if you didn't know any better, or if you weren't reading this as a novel reader, you would think, oh, you know, this Dickens guy really loves the mm-hmm. British government, or, you know, royalty, the Queen. In fact, he's not. He's putting in a critique there. Mm-hmm. So there are two voices. So at first he was just a narrator telling about a story, and suddenly
there's a change of tone.
Yes, exactly. So that's,
and it's ironic.
Exactly. Right. So that's kind of the heteroglossia in, you know, at least in the novel. That's one example. Now in Shadow Puppet Theatre, the dalang sometimes is I'm giving kind of more examples from Thailand and Indonesia, because unfortunately here we don't really do it that as extensively as it is in these other places. Shadow puppet troupe might be commissioned by some civil servant, top level civil servant, to for the inauguration of a new restaurant or something like that, or a new shopping complex, and at the same time that the dalang would be praising his host, he might be putting jabs at the same time. Mm-hmm. And because of the context of the shadow puppet performance, he's completely immune to any kind of repercussions. Whereas if he had tried to do this directly, it would be a totally different thing. So there's the heteroglossia of the dalang is within his craft, and he does it constantly. So this is, for example, when he's introducing the story. Another way that's more potent that this happens is when he's giving the different voices for the different characters. There's one set of characters which the clowns, And they are clowns, but they are the ones who usually know everything that's going on in the story. And sometimes they actually turn to the audience and kind of, you know, put one hand to the side of the face and say, well, actually, it's this guy who did it and not that guy. So there's this multiple voices. There are dialogues going on. So it's not just us, for example, sitting in a movie theater and watching a story unfold. You know, the audience, the dalang, the puppets are all in cahoots with telling not just the story that's happening, but the stories that are in that are issues to that society of that time. Mm-hmm.
So this is radically different from earlier literary forms where you'd had a single voice. Is that how?
Yeah, I guess that's one. I mean, again, you know, not everybody. Back then, you know, like other scholars will, you know, would have his critics. But what he's saying, he wanted to highlight the power of the novel. And the connections that some performing arts scholars are making between that, between, you know, the power of the novel and the power of the performing arts is this ability and this basically freedom to tell, to present multiple voices in one time space. You know, so it's not so much the dalang saying, I feel this way, so I'm going to share my opinion with you and that's it. He's actually presenting a dialogue. So most of the time, you don't actually know where the dalang stands. And this is something that Bakhtin brings up also. Most of the time, we actually don't know where the author, him or herself, stands when we're, you know, watching the story unfold in the novel.
One of the things that struck me is that when you theorize a novel, you're theorizing a form that is quintessentially modern. Whereas when you take this and you use it to read a form like The Wayang Kulit, you're looking at a pre-modern performance form that actually existed in feudal society. And so while you might say that, well, you know, modernity, democracy, heteroglossia all kind of come together in a neat package, the image I have of feudal society is much, perhaps it's completely wrong, but I would think of it as, you know, more top-down, authoritarian,
right.
Lacking that kind of democratic
right.
space or dynamic, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what is it that the performance form tells us about the society in which it actually emerged from?
Right. So what it has helped me as not just an aspiring scholar, but also as a person, as a participating member of the society, is that we have a pretty rigid view of what our past was like. It, you know, precisely like how what you mentioned, there was always, you know, resistance. There was always agency. It's not our image, our view, or our memory of what we think feudal society was like is very unchanging. And this is one way for us to have a window into what it might have actually been like, and for us to also make the parallels with our current society. In other words, we shouldn't see ourselves as, you know, having come from a feudal society, because if we look at these genres that have been around for a long time, and yes, there are different kinds. You know, there are very, very old shadow puppetry forms that were only commissioned by the royal court, and of course you wouldn't probably be, you know, making, you know, ironic jokes and things like that. But for the most part, the people's shadow puppetry was very much about letting them enjoy a time and space where they can have these dialogues, these questions in their heads.
That's fascinating. We're going to be back with more on the concept of heteroglossia, the work of Michael Bakhtin, with Anesia Azmi and Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, myself, Sharad Kutan. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Night School. I'm Sharad Kutin, along with Amar Fuad Ramad and Nezia Azmi, who's been talking to us about the concept of heteroglossia and the work of Russian theorist Mikhail Bakhtin. And its relationship to performance, which is what Nezia studies and is in fact involved in as a practitioner. Fuad, you had a question.
Yes, I'm particularly taken by how dynamic the space that the Dalang is operating in compared to the novelist, right? Because the novelist is bound to the text, essentially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the novelist is bound to a certain habit or even system of production where he is, for lack of a better word, freezing his ideas into these pages, editing it, restructuring it, so on and so forth. Whereas the Dalang is just really just expressing the moment.
Right.
He's always bound to the audience of the time and the context that they were witnessing his performance. In many ways, it's expressing a more interesting layer of freedom that you just can't find in the author,
right,
the novelist.
Right. Yeah. It's more real time. It's mm-hmm. more live. There's a line from the introduction to this essay by Michael Holquist, which is probably one of the most prolific translators and scholars of Bakhtin. And he has he mentions here about this particular discourse in the novel. Bakhtin's sense of a duel between more widely implicated forces leads in the opposite direction and stresses the fragility and ineluctably historical nature of language, the coming and dying of meaning, that it, as a phenomenon, shares with that other phenomenon. It ventriloquates men. So ventriloquism, if you guys know, you know when people put their hands up a puppet's
backside
and, you know, kind of makes the mouth move, the puppet usually looks freaky and scary. So that's a ventriloquism. What's interesting about that versus other kinds of puppetry is that you know it's that guy making that voice. So you see the so-called author right there, and you totally, as a viewer, accepts that. So in other words, you are witnessing and you are part and parcel of this dialogue and this, basically admitting that, yeah, I know you're the one making these comments, but you're doing it through this puppet, right? So Southeast Asian shadow puppetry versus other kinds of puppetry where you can't see the puppeteer, where the puppeteer hides somewhere, has the same quality that Michael Holquist was describing about what Bakhtin saw, which is that it includes the voice of the person, the human being, the man and the woman, the men and the women and the boys and girls involved in all of these stories that are being told. And that makes that medium a much more alive and interesting versus when you're just watching a movie where you don't ever see the filmmaker or the director or the, you know, the cinematographer. It makes you part of the creation because you are admitting, you know, the author is there. So you're in this conversation, you're in this dialogue. Now, how does this translate? How does this occur in Southeast Asian puppetry? I have some really interesting examples. In Wayang Golek, which is a Sundanese rod puppetry, so it's not shadows, it's rods. Basically, you're moving puppets.
Made out of wood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, made out of wood. And the Dalang sits behind a raised kind of partition so that you don't really see his hands going up the puppet's backside or bottom side. But the Dalang's top of the Dalang head is always seen. So you don't, it's for first time viewers, it's very disorienting because you know there's this guy behind that piece of plank that's doing all of this.
And it's purposeful.
It's purposeful, exactly. So it's done on purpose. It's not like a kind of an accident or anything like that. In fact, you have to see the Dalang's head because it's all part of the ritual. And Wayang Golek is usually more ritualistic than it is only entertainment. And it's all part and parcel of the entire performance.
But why?
The Dalang, apart from being the storyteller, sometimes the conductor for the music, musical accompaniment, the actual puppeteer, the different voices, he's also usually the priest. So a lot of shadow puppet theatre performances in many parts of Indonesia and Thailand, maybe more so Indonesia, is a part of a cleansing ceremony, a cleansing ritual. You know, if a village has had, you know, a bad drought, or some, you know, too many people died, or there was food poisoning or something, and they feel like they need to kind of, you know, have a cleansing ceremony, they do this with a shadow puppet theater performance. So the priest, the dalang doubles as a priest. So he's not just an entertainer, he's a priest, and he has to have a presence in this. So the actual, the watching is not entertainment, the ritual is actually happening through the performance of this this shadow puppetry.
I think this is all fascinating. I think the comparison is really accentuating all these features of narrative dynamism in our indigenous local forms of art that we would not see otherwise, I think. But I can't help sensing that our conversation is a bit acontextual, in that the reality is that all these forms of art are fading. They're not getting much more support. They're not getting much more familiarity in our context. We're becoming a more textual culture with social media. Mm-hmm. People want to express themselves. They tend to the novel. They don't look for wayang. What's being lost in this transition, Nazia?
You mean in us not really not watching shadow puppet theater?
Yeah, not being
regularly,
not identifying with it, not appreciating
right.
it. Because
right.
this is not just a form of expression. This is not just a way to hang out. There's a transition in our subjectivities. There's a transition
right.
in how we understand personhood and how we understand art.
Right.
What have you observed in this comparison?
Just, you know, personal opinion. It's a great loss. I feel very lucky that when I was doing research here and there and traveling, you know, throughout the region, that I got to see these performances. And, you know, mind you, they're not in the context of you buy a ticket and then you sit in an auditorium and you watch a show. I think for most people in KL, in Malaysia, that sounds very boring. So for us, the primary way for us to even watch a wayang kulit performance is that. And I think that's where the losing in translation happens, because when I went to these other performances in, you know, other countries, Indonesia primarily, it was very social at the same time that it was ritualistic, at the same time that it was religious and spiritual and political. So, and this brings us back to Bakhtin also, because one of the sub-concepts under heteroglossia is the carnivalesque. So these performances that I had been to had that carnival feeling. So it was still very much enjoyable, but at the same time, you're sitting there and you are being asked in a way to think about what society we are living in today. And we don't really get to do that here in KL or in Malaysia using our indigenous traditions. We do a lot of political, you know, commentary and analysis, but it's, you know, primarily through very modern media like, you know, the radio, a print, online, Facebook, and things like that. And I think we're losing out because all those other things are very much, you're not in the moment. You're thinking about something, then you type it up, and then you hit, you know, send or submit, and then the rest of the world sees it.
I want to do a plug for the now. And I know, of course, that, you know, I suspect sometimes there's a bit of nostalgia when we talk about older forms, especially forms that are receding and are kind of being eclipsed by more modern forms. But what's interesting about Bakhtin is that he's theorizing a new and emerging form, right? Yeah. Something that was only beginning to take shape. And he saw in it its specificity, what was unique about that form. Mm-hmm. And I guess if Bakhtin lived in this time, he would be saying it, he wouldn't be theorizing the novel, he would be theorizing perhaps Facebook.
Yeah, oh,
I mean,
totally.
Potentially,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
As that new form and looking at what it gives us. I mean, it might not be a celebration. I want to ask you this, in mm-hmm. fact, is heteroglossia a kind of, is there a normative dimension to that? Is it saying heteroglossia is good, or is it merely a descriptive category?
It is more descriptive than it is normative. What he was adamant about was, hey, look at this new genre, don't discount it as you know, popular mass consumption of bad writing. It's not.
So this was the critique of the time.
Yes, he was making this critique. And, you know, he got a lot of bad rap for it. I mean, his dissertation was not ever published, or it was not passed by his panel at the university, because it was too radical. It was too, it was elevating, you know, a very kind of mass-produced form of literature. So he was putting in the plug during that time. So yeah, I totally agree with you.
I mean, the irony is not, the novel is now seen as a kind of a high moment in
exactly
literature.
Right.
I think again, we got to be careful here. It's not about romanticizing the past against the present, but I think to check our attachments to modern forms too, because I think especially in the Malay context there is this shame towards these more, you know, indigenous and folk forms,
right,
of expression.
That is primitive, or it's
that's
not
primitive,
deep,
correct,
yeah.
And that, you know, what we have now is better. We want to avoid that too, right? So what makes looking back to these forms more interesting is that we can now check ourselves in our engagement with the contemporary time and see that while we've lost a lot too in the process of gaining other things.
Right. And to even I actually don't like the word revival, but just to kind of be open-minded about all the existing media out there. You know, when I was in New York City, plenty of people were doing puppetry, and not like traditional old puppetry or anything like that. They're well-versed in it, but they're using it for in collaboration with more medium, with more modern media.
You said that out of the notion of heteroglossia comes a range of other notions or concepts, and you listed some of them, including mm-hmm. the carnivalesque. And
yeah.
I've heard of this, you know, with relation to Michael Bakhtin. Could you say a little bit about that? Because
yeah,
I think
sure.
it's kind of a... potentially fun. I don't know, the carnival.
Yeah. So basically, it's a way of upending social hierarchy, because when you go to a carnival, or you know, what we know about the carnival is that you go there and everything is meant to be seen, because because of their ridiculousness. Right, and then it kind of levels everyone together. So everyone's just as ridiculous as each other. So this is kind of the carnivalesque, which is immediately tied to the grotesque. The grotesque usually looks at, it basically puts in the spotlight, you know, bodily functions that we usually don't talk about, like body parts that excrete waste, or body parts that can penetrate other people's body parts. So it's very, you know, is we kind of like we don't talk about that. That's taboo. But he basically, I don't want to say he elevated it, but he highlighted it as a way for authors to make social commentary, and sometimes sociocultural or sociopolitical commentary, in the most simple way. Is basically saying we're all the same because we have the same orifices on our bodies. You know, so for example, in the southern Thailand shadow puppetry, the clown characters, which are the most sacred and the most important, here again, you know, the clown is actually the most important. It's not the king or the queen or the prince and princess characters. It's actually the clown characters who are usually the most important and sacred. They look the most grotesque. They either have huge, big bellies, and there's one, I can't recall the name of the puppet, but he's a very important puppet. His finger, I don't know if you might have to, you know, bleep this out, is in the shape of a penis. And these are all, it's not only for the shock factor, it's basically trying to equalize everything that, you know, when we say we can't do this or we can only do this, it's in a way artificial, because we then say those people who can't do this is because they are of a lower caste, mm-hmm. or they are not as rich, or, you know, they're not as educated. When you put a clown, who is the most important character and the most important element, sacred element to this, you know, entire troupe, and he has a penis as one of his fingers, what are you trying to say, right?
Right, it devalues pride.
Right.
Because I think hierarchy is an arrangement of pride according to various, you know, where you're supposed to stand in a social standing. But with that, what it does is dismantle it.
Right. It kind of dissolves all those different things.
Because it holds two different things together. Mm-hmm. So the sacred and the profane are kind of meshed together.
Exactly.
And you can't pull them apart.
Right.
But what you're saying is in these performances, they come together and actually are about... maybe complicating our way of looking at life.
Yeah.
It's
right.
not so they not these neat categories.
Right.
But I don't think they're complicating. They're going further. They're subverting.
Subverting, right? That's the word. That's the word.
They're actually transgressing
right.
this. Yeah.
It's not necessarily they're saying, oh, it's better to be gross and profane and, you know, offensive. I don't think that's what it's trying to say. It's basically trying to say. Whether you're looking at the king puppet or the clown puppet that has a penis on his finger, as is one of his fingers, it doesn't matter. You're witnessing, you're not witnessing, you're watching this story, you're participating, and it's okay. Nobody gets hurt. That's what's so beautiful to me, you know, bias, of course, in the performing arts. You enter that time and space, and anything goes. Anything goes, but it's a safe space. It's not like you have to be stuck in that anything goes environment like a bad dream. You can leave it, but during that time and space, you are part of this. You can enjoy it. You can maybe hate it, but it makes you think.
I want to come back very quickly to something that Fuad brought up about the writing of the novel being somehow, passive and so constructed that there is no freedom in it. But I didn't say
there's no freedom. I'm saying compared to the Dalang.
Okay, compared to the Dalang.
Because
I want to make a plug for the question of the reader, you know, especially in a novel that is complex. I mean, in a really good novel, not some,
novel. Like Ulysses or something.
I found it extraordinary difficult to read, actually. I couldn't get past page one, and I think that was still the first paragraph. The idea that the reader is part of this process of trying to interpret what's going on. I think you mentioned the word polysemy, you know? Polysemy?
Polyphony?
Polyphony.
Right.
Which is, again, about the multiplication of...
The multiple voices.
Right?
Right.
And more, surely one of those voices is the voice... in the mind of the reader, right? They're kind of like in the novel.
Right.
And it must be also the nature of the word. I mean, words and meanings are not fixed. Even in a novel, the author has no control over the kind of value or weight that you put on a word, right? I mean, it's shifting. I'm not a literary scholar, so I'm sort of like speculating wildly here, you know, but it seems to me that that's where the freedom is. But it's a very personal one. The text
exactly,
and the reader,
right.
as opposed to a collective one, which you have in a performance situation.
Right. Mm. Yeah. I mean, Bakhtin was, you know, he was a semiotician, right? So he wasn't a structural linguist. So he was kind of the response or the reaction to that by saying that you can't attach only one meaning to the word. And to respond to your commentary about Fuad's mention of the text being more frozen compared to the Dalang, which, you know, I do agree with. But at the same time, when you're reading a great novel, you have many voices in your head. And sometimes it's not just you imagining the dialogues going on between the characters in the novel or between the narrator and the characters. Sometimes you're having a conversation with yourself. Did he do it? Or did she do it? Why was she doing that? You know, so this kind of experiencing of the discourse, like a very visceral and physical material experiencing is, I think, what Bakhtin was talking about and where is what I think is also so prevalent in experiencing shadow puppet theatre.
But I think, just to stress on that point, it's a hallmark of modernity, right? This hearing voices in your head, essentially, when you read. Whereas what happens at these puppet events is they're out there. The voices are actually out, you're interacting. It's more material. Of course, there are all these elements in a novel that you can find in other forms of art, but it's just about that. It's about whether it's an abstraction. It remains an abstraction in you, which is very modern, right? People, you know, the age of individuality, the age of isolation, and the novel kind of speaks to that. Whereas in this age, you have a more social existence. You have everything uttered and felt in that moment, which I long for. in my engagement with art now, you know. Everything is so isolated. That's why I don't have Twitter.
Okay. So at the end of this, what do you now want to go and watch a performance, or would you rather read Bakhtin's work?
I would rather watch a performance. If Bakhtin's work can be acted out in a performance, that'll be perfect for me.
Oh, goodness.
He's very hard to read.
Easy. Oh,
yeah,
goodness.
Yeah. Okay. But it's doable. That's why if you read Michael Holquist's introduction to, you know, each of his different essays, it really helps.
Okay, so that's what you're going to recommend. And maybe you could just mention the title of the collection.
Yeah, the name of the book is The Dialogic Imagination by Mikhail Bakhtin, translated by Carol Emerson and Michael Holquist. And this particular discussion is based on the last and most comprehensive of the chapters, which is the last chapter. It's called Discourse in the Novel.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Nezia. Nezia Azmi, who is a cultural worker. She's attached to Rhythm and Bronze, which is a contemporary gamelan music group.
Yeah.
And Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, who's been here. We can continue this conversation on Facebook. Yeah. So join us at BFM Night School. You can also write questions to us via our Gmail account. That's bfmnightschool@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter. Unlike Fuad, my handle is @SharadKutun. Nezia, are you on Twitter?
Yes, at Nezia Azmi, one word.
Okay, yes. Nezia is spelled N-E-Z-I-A. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating. We've been talking about the notion of heteroglossia and the work of the Russian theorist Michael Bakhtin, but also the practice of performance in Southeast Asia. You've been listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, Nezia Azmi, and myself, Sharad Kutun, on Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.